You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. My guest today is Dr. Abbas Milani. He's the Hamid and Christina Moghaddam Director of Iranian Studies here at Stanford, an affiliate at the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law here at FSI, and he's also a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and my colleague for many, many years. It's great to have you here today, Abbas. Before coming to Stanford, he was a professor of law and political science at Tehran University and a member of the board of directors of Tehran's Center for International Studies. We're here today, of course, to talk about recent events in Iran, U.S.-Iranian relations. Thanks, Abbas, for joining World Class.
It's a pleasure to be with you, as always.
Great. Let's start with a little context before we get to recent events. The Trump administration came into power, and in my view, and I know we've talked about it, adopted pretty, what I would consider, pretty standard objectives that they were seeking to achieve with respect to their policy towards Iran, denying Iran the bomb, reducing influence of Iran in the region, reducing terrorism, and some would add to that, increasing support for democracy inside Iran, although not doesn't seem like everybody agrees with that in the Trump administration. But they adopted a pretty different strategy. They call it maximum pressure. They withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, increased sanctions. So in other words, to achieve old objectives, they were trying new strategies. How was it working before the events of the last week or so?
I think the only aspect of it that was working according to their plan was economic pressure. The sanctions were intended to put economic pressure on the regime. They did. They also put economic pressure on the Iranian people.
Right.
But it was essentially exacerbating an already exacerbated condition. The Iranian economy is profoundly corrupt, profoundly cronyist, profoundly mismanaged. The sanctions increased the pain and increased the process. Other than that, I don't think the objectives that you have indicated, as well as another objective that some of the Trump administration people have had and openly declared, that is regime change.
Right.
Mr. Bolton, for example, most famously.
Right. He's pretty Pompeo, open about it, right?
He was very open about it. They go to the meetings of Iranian opposition groups and suggest that they are the next regime in Iran, that the regime in Iran is going to fall. The gentleman that used to be everywhere, no longer around, but was the attorney for the president, he would go around to these meetings.
Mr. Giuliani,
Mr. Giuliani.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Giuliani, because nobody is mentioning his name.
Yes, he seems to have disappeared.
Interesting. Right.
He too was involved in
these. Literally went to a couple of these meetings and declared that this group is the next successor. And
the MEK, is that what you're talking about? Tell our listeners who the MEK is. Well,
the MEK is a group that has been active in Iranian politics for over half a century. They began as a radical combination of some versions of Marxism and their own version of Islam. They began in what they used to call guerrilla activity.
Uh-huh.
Today, we call them terrorist activity.
Right.
They're the only guerrilla terrorist activity who actually killed Americans in Iran before the revolution.
I did not know that.
Absolutely. They're the only group. They became very close to the Iranian regime, but soon they began to fall apart. They had parting of ways. They fought the regime ferociously. They killed several thousand of the regime. The regime killed several thousand of them. And then they decided to choose a life of exile, most of them. They went exiled in Iraq and became very close to Saddam Hussein, who gave them a base, allowed them to attack Iran. And then when Saddam fell, they were searching for a new place. They eventually landed in Albania. Some in the Trump administration think that they're the next alternative.
Right.
I don't think they have much of a social base in Iran. I think because they were in cahoots with Saddam, when Saddam was attacking Iran, they lost a lot of their legitimacy.
Right.
So that aspect of the Trump policy, which has always been implied, that certainly hasn't worked.
Right.
But the economic pressure has worked.
Right. And so how did the regime respond to that pressure?
The regime responded to the economic pressure by blaming the United States
and
deflecting all criticism about its own incompetence.
Right.
But it wasn't really having much of effectiveness. People were becoming increasingly angry at the regime. And when about 2.5 months ago, the regime suddenly, literally at midnight, tripled the price of gasoline.
Right.
Although gasoline was subsidized, but nevertheless, it's an essential commodity in people's lives. The next day, all hell broke loose. People took to the streets. Soon it spread to over 100. The regime has called it the closest...
100 cities, right?
100
cities. So all over Iran, not just the liberal intelligentsia in Tehran, but all...
Actually, the liberal intelligentsia was almost not at all involved.
Interesting.
These were the what they would call mostazaf, what in the Soviet days they would have called the proletariat.
Oh.
There, this was really a proletarian uprising.
Uh-huh.
And there
and
was
principally about economic hardship, right?
It was
right?
principally about economic hardship.
Okay. And
principally worrying about 50 at least percent inflation, 20 to 30% unemployment, 60% unemployment for women college graduates, and shortages of some of the commodities that people need, shortage of medicine. And I am absolutely against sanctioning medicine, incidentally.
Right.
And the regime, after a couple of days, freaked out and brought enormous violence against people. Upward of 1,000 people have been killed.
And that's unprecedented, right? That's never happened before?
In demonstrations, no. The regime has killed more than 1,000
right.
in a span of 3 months, for example, in 1988, where they went to prison and killed a lot of the MEK who were in prison.
Okay.
But never in demonstrations, never under the Shah.
Okay.
And arrested upward of 7,000 people. Shut down the internet, 95% of the internet. They took their cues from China. They took their cues from North Korea. They took their cues from Russia. And they're trying to literally create a kind of digital iron curtain.
Right, right.
That was the condition 60 days ago.
Okay.
And then the United States decided to take out Soleimani. And
that's a little bit about who he is, just so we understand his background.
Qasem Soleimani is a very unusual commander of the IRGC. IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is the militia that the regime created to parallel the traditional military, which they thought were royalist. And they kept...
Oh, that's their origins.
That's their origins.
They were afraid of the conventional military.
Absolutely. And gradually, they decreased the budget for the traditional military and increased the budget for this.
Okay.
And then from within that, they carved out a group called it the Quds Brigade. Quds is the Arabic for the name of Jerusalem. It was the arm of the regime that worked in Middle East.
Okay.
Hezbollah in Lebanon is virtually created by the Quds Brigade, and Soleimani had a very important role in it. Soleimani was instrumental in creating radical Shiite groups in Iraq, for example, radical groups in Palestine. Soleimani was absolutely instrumental in keeping Assad in power. He and the Quds Brigade were absolutely instrumental in bringing thousands of Shiites from Afghanistan and have them fight in Syria in favor of Assad.
Wow.
I just saw a tape from a member of an Afghan parliament, a very brave lady, who said Soleimani is responsible for the death of 5,500, this is her figure, Afghans. Who were taken in what is called the Fatimiyun Brigade to fight in Afghanistan. Aside from this role, he had a very unusual relationship with Khamenei. I think there is
the supreme leader.
The supreme leader. There is no one, I think, in Iranian domestic structure that was as close to Khamenei, that Khamenei liked as much, and Khamenei trusted as much.
Okay.
And when he was taken out, it was a very direct hit to the power structure.
Right.
But there is something else about Soleimani that I think needs to be understood. From 2-3 years ago, the regime began a very sophisticated PR campaign to create out of him a kind of iconic figure.
Okay.
Saying that he's not the normal IRGC, he's a poet, he's a mystic, he's not corrupt. They had him kiss babies, they had him cry in mourning ceremonies, they had him say, I'm a simple soldier of Vali Faqih. So they really created a different image for him.
And why was that? Were they getting ready to make him president, or what do you think?
That was absolutely the common rumor amongst the cognoscenti,
right,
that he is the last straw. If they really think that things are going from bad to worse,
go to him.
And they allowed him to create this image for himself. And the fact that he was truly less corrupt, apparently, than the rest of the IRGC commanders,
mm-hmm,
helped give him that cachet.
Right.
When the U.S. hit him, the Iranian regime went all out. They literally shut down the country for 3 days. Iranian radio and television, the monopoly of the government, around the clock was singing his praise, using national songs, secular national songs that created a nationalist fervor, talked about him, the soldier of the nation, as well as a soldier of IRGC. And thus they got the remarkable outpouring.
Of the millions of people we saw, or hundreds of, what are
hundreds of thousands? If I taught at Tehran University, where was the center of this. Tehran University, that place doesn't hold more than 30, 40,000.
Right.
But streets were absolutely
filled,
brimful.
And what happened to the protesters that you mentioned earlier that were protesting against the regime for economic grievances? How did they respond and react to the death of Soleimani?
You know, we don't have exact data from the outpouring of this sentiment and from some anecdotal evidence. Some of them absolutely pulled back their punches. Some of them were angered that, after all, an Iranian has been hit in Iraq. So all of the dynamics, I think, changed in favor of the regime.
Okay.
A regime that was badly wounded, badly enfeebled, now suddenly felt
emboldened. So then explain to us your assessment of at least their initial response to the killing of Soleimani. They fired a bunch of rockets at two Iraqi bases, but nobody was killed. Explain that for us, and what does it mean about the short term and the long term?
You know, they began to talk about how Khamenei himself began to talk about immediate revenge, total revenge, all kinds of rhetorical bombast.
Okay.
But when they had to do something because of the bombast that they had themselves created, they decided that if they really go after U.S. personnel, Trump might get back at them.
Right. So they were worried about tit-for-tat escalation.
Absolutely, I think they were.
Okay.
And they very, I think, calculated where they were going to hit.
Okay.
If they wanted to hit the U.S., they could have hit U.S. naval bases, for example, in Bahrain, that
right.
are as close to Iran as the base they hit. The IRGC actually published a map of all U.S. bases in the vicinity of Iran, 28 bases, I think, and said, look, there are 70,000 Americans about here. We can hit any of these. But the one they hit, and by all accounts, they told Iraq, I have no evidence for it, but I would be profoundly surprised if Iraq didn't tell the U.S. that these missiles are coming.
Okay.
The U.S. moved, fortunately, all the personnel. They had two hits. They had multiple missiles. There was no loss of life. They had done their duty of revenge, and they had done it in a way that would allow President Trump to de-escalate.
Uh-huh. And so the claim, I've been seeing some reports out of Iran saying that 80 Americans were killed. That's also for domestic consumption. They're satisfied.
That's exactly, in my understanding, and they keep repeating. That, don't believe what the Americans are saying. We killed 80 Americans, and they have an image of a base where there is parts of an airplane that they have hit. Said, look how much destruction this has brought. This couldn't be. The IRGC commander said we hit the U.S.'s central command structure.
Right.
So they're going out of their way to exaggerate
right.
the impact of that.
And then, of course, we've been learning today that the details are still not exactly clear, but it looks like Iran inadvertently or accidentally shot down a Ukrainian airline filled mostly with Iranians, by the way, looking at the manifest. We're just learning these details as we speak, but it looks like it was part of the fog of war and it was a mistake. What will happen inside Iran as the events and that tragedy becomes better known within society?
I think two things happened. This is the second thing that happened. The first thing happened was in Kerman, birthplace of Soleimani.
Right.
When people came into the street, the regime was so incompetent. They had actually done nothing to prepare for the throng of people.
Right.
At least 70 people were killed.
70?
At least. 200 were... This is the government's official number.
Right.
And people were very angry. With this one, I think the level of anger is going to increase if it comes very clear. And Canada has taken a position that we have evidence that this was a missile.
Right, hit. Right.
The U.S. has done it. Many people were skeptical whether the U.S.'s claim is part of the fog of war.
Of course, right.
And the New York Times has published an image that shows clearly something hitting. And you're right, there is at least 70-odd Iranians. 35 of these were the intellectual, scientific elite of the country that were going to Canada. Some of them are some of the most brilliant, and I don't mean hyperbolically.
I mean,
a gold medal winner in computer science.
Wow.
The anger is in social media, the anger from the regimes not shutting down the airport.
Right.
If you're engaged in a lobbying of missiles
right.
against the United States, the least thing you can do is shut down the airport.
Right.
For a few hours. The other thing that I think is going to add to the anger is the regime's response in the first 24 hours after this massive show of national unity, whatever you want to call it. Papers closest to the IRGC, papers closest to Khamenei, published remarkably angry commentaries, not against the United States, but against Iranian reformists, against Iranian Democrats, suggesting we should go after all of these. Anyone who has ever suggested negotiating with the United States is our enemy.
Okay.
So they're doubling down on oppression rather than using this show of sentiment
right.
as a possible opening for a national dialogue, at least, if not reconciliation.
That's sobering. So to conclude, obviously predicting the future is very difficult. It's a very volatile situation. The events change literally every day. But I'm curious on two different fronts, Abbas. First, what do you think will be the long-term implications for the regime of this set of events? You've already started to hint at that, but how will that play out? And secondly, how will it play out vis-a-vis the United States? President Trump, in his speech about the events, said he's going to increase pressure and increase sanctions, but he also hinted that he wanted to negotiate. Is that a possibility? So both domestically, how this affects things, and then how it affects the bilateral relationship.
Domestically, I think if the regime had any prudence, they could have used this to their own benefit. As I suggested, at a moment of crisis, we are now together, let's solve some of these problems. They're doubling down on oppression. And the economic difficulties are not going away.
Right.
Those economic difficulties that got us the 2 months ago, demonstrations in hundreds of cities that the regime called closest thing to a third world war.
Right.
Those are going to be even more.
Right.
So my guess would be because of the way they have handled all of this, those demonstrations are going to come back.
Come back.
And they're
okay.
going to come back to haunt them. And prudent U.S. policy, in my view, would be to avoid these kinds of gestures that feeds into the regime's narrative and help the Iranian democratic movement, not by deciding who the next successor is going to be. The
right.
next successor has to be determined by the Iranian people.
Right.
The Iranian people are the only people who can bring democracy to Iran, and they want to bring democracy to Iran. The U.S. can help, but by interfering, or by doing hits like Soleimani, they can also impede that process.
Right. And prospects for a nuclear deal? A new nuclear deal, I should say, because we already had one that got on its last breath. But could that happen?
My guess is not, but you never know what President Trump would do.
Right.
President Trump might decide that it's okay
right.
for Iran, for example, to have all of the things that
he said they couldn't.
That
right.
he said they couldn't, if he can get a deal out of them. But my sense is that Iran is moving in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
Iran has already jettisoned all commitments that they had accepted
right.
on the nuclear deal. There is a bill going through the Iranian parliament right now as we speak, sponsored by a person who used to be one of the moderates, one of the critics of the radicals, suggesting that Iran should get out of NPT. There are people
the
in
nuclear
Iran.
Non-proliferation.
And
right.
there are radical elements within Iran who have long been saying that we should have had the bomb before. They say, look at North Korea. Look at the way the U.S. treats North Korea.
Right.
And look at the way they treat us.
Wow.
If we had the bomb, they would have never dared do
this.
To
us.
So the discrepancy that you have sometimes pointed in some
between
of your conversations
between those two cases,
between
right?
those
North Korea
cases,
and Iran, yeah.
With North Korea and Iran. Iranians, are, the regime is following that very carefully and very cleverly using it to show that there are discrepancies and inconsistencies.
Right.
And the radicals are using it to say, since we're going to have it out with the U.S. anyway,
right.
Might let's well get the Obama. North Korean treatment rather than the Saddam treatment.
Interesting. Well, thanks, Abbas, for being with us. I know that this will not be the last time we speak about this topic this year. I suspect there's a lot more drama to come. But thank you for sharing your wisdom about what's going on so far.
It's always a pleasure talking with you.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you liked this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.